Welcome to Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. This is Ender's Game, the book club for Ender's Game, chapters 11 and 12, Veni, Vidi, Vici, and Bonzo. I'm Matt Rather, and with me is the foremost authority on Ender's Game in the world, Ben Adams. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
It's going well. So we're going to jump in like we have been these last couple with some of the responses from the forums, one in particular highlighting one response. And you can join this conversation in the Overthinking It forums by clicking forums in the main menu of Overthinking It or following the link from the show notes on each of these podcast episodes. And so we get the questions going, we get the discussion going rather with some study questions that Ben posts every week. You also can start your own topics, and there are a couple of interesting ones that have sprung up, but let's look at the study questions for chapters 11 and 12. Ben begins study question number 3 with a quotation from Graf. He says, Ender Wiggin isn't a killer. He just wins thoroughly. Does this distinction, Ben asks, have a meaningful difference? Take a look at Ender's reasoning for the level of force he uses against Bonzo. Do you agree? So Bastion of Light responds to question 3 by saying, the distinction does not have a meaningful difference to the people he killed. They end up dead regardless. It does create a meaningful difference to Graf, as Graf is attempting to control Ender. It means that, unlike perhaps Peter early on, Ender cannot be convinced to kill if it's framed to him as a killing. The idea of winning evokes a game paradigm, a level of abstraction which helps to obscure the real consequences of behavior. And I'll just break in for a second to Bastion of Light's comment and say you can go back to week one of the podcast to hear Ben and me kind of ring the changes on what games mean, and you know, aspects of sort of delineation of rules and of kind of levels of reality or levels of abstraction that are attendant on the idea of a game. Bastion of Light continues, this is why the trope exists, where in preparation for real combat, an authority figure has to remind someone that this is not a game, and that actions will have real consequences, including death. And Ben, I just want to tell you, this podcast is not a game. It's a real podcast.
We are playing with live ammunition around here.
Right.
Live podcast and ammunition.
Which means Skype, I think. Of course, if you tried to remind, and then Bastion of Light links out to a TV Tropes article for Not a Game. The interesting thing to me is that... Is the distinction between the it's not a game trope, this is not a game, and the, well, this isn't some kind of TV show, you know, that you hear in TV shows that are, in fact, some kind of TV show. You hear that all the time. And it's a little more in-world, right? It's a little less alienating to hear this isn't a game. Because saying, like, this isn't a TV show points up the fact that it is a TV show and usually has to do, well, I shouldn't say usually, but often has to do with the TV shows trying to make a claim that its narrative is superior to other TV shows in some way, right? Like, this isn't a TV show because this is gritty realism, right? Because it's the claim that's actually being made, right? Like, in the sense of the ulterior claim is that this TV show is, in fact, a TV show, but it's a better TV show than other TV shows because right. It's more, scare quotes, realistic or something. So Bastion of Light continues, of course, if you tried to remind Ender that what he was doing was not a game, it would not work to make him more serious. Actual contemplation of mortal consequences would likely make Ender rebel against the task because Ender is not psychologically prepared to kill people. They need to lie to him about Stilson and Bonzo in order to preserve the game mentality. So long as he believes that winning thoroughly doesn't involve killing, he can be counted on to win thoroughly and kill as many people as he needs to. So I don't know. What do you think of this, Ben? I think it makes sense. And the idea that like Ender has to be convinced that this is somehow pretend or somehow abstract, somehow not real, because he has a capacity for empathy, which is something that we'll get into, I think, in next week, and talking about Ender's relationship with his enemies. But that capacity for empathy would prevent him from being able to, carry out, the necessary exercise of violence in war fighting. And for this reason, he has to be kept in the dark.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm particularly drawn to this line that Ender is not psychologically prepared to kill people, because it's interesting because, of course, he does kill people. I mean, he did it with Bonzo. But, of course, whether or not he meant to do that is kind of an interesting question. I mean, he's at this point, he's older. He's supposed to be this brilliant child. So it's not like he doesn't know the potential mortal consequences. He certainly knows that he could be killed in this fight by Bonzo. And so presumably he's also aware that the level of force he's using against Bonzo could potentially cause Bonzo's death.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite certain that it's that he's not psychologically prepared to kill people so much as it is that he's not psychologically prepared to have killed someone, that the knowledge of killing someone would change Ender's relationship with force, with killing, with playing this game that he's playing. And so that's why the battle school has to hide the fact that Bonzo was killed from Ender, because they're afraid of what it's going to do to his psychology if he kind of not just knows the abstract consequences, but actually feels the consequences. It's the difference between knowing that if you drink and drive, you might kill someone and waking up the next morning and finding out you ran somebody over.
Sure. That's an interesting distinction. I guess there's a difference between sort of preemptive war against the buggers and defending yourself, or, I don't know, or best defense is a good offensing yourself, in a schoolyard fight, or in, getting, jumped by a lot of guys in a bathroom, right?
Right. There's actually an interesting distinction in international law, which is that you're under, this is really baseline international law, but the under the UN Charter, you're not allowed to attack someone unless it's in self-defense. But there's kind of a baseline distinction there, which is if you can do a spoiling attack, if the other side's troops are massing on the border and it's clear they're going to attack at any moment, you don't have to wait until they've actually crossed the border. Under international law, in order to attack, you can kind of do a spoiling attack, because the best defense is a good offense sometimes. And of course, this is subject to all sorts of people abusing this provision and arguments back and forth. But that's at least the baseline international law principle,
right? About whether it's good. And I mean, not to get political, but the Bush doctrine of preemptive war is on point here. That is to say, what constitutes a threat that is so, present or so clear and present.
Right. And I should note that
peace be upon Tom Clancy,
I should just note that the exception I'm talking about really doesn't apply in a situation where it's like a long-term imminent threat. It really only applies where like literally the enemy's planes are in the air and the tanks are like rolling towards your border.
Sure. A lot of troop movements in that Warsaw Pact, right?
Right. Train schedules and whatnot.
The idea though, there is kind of a dodge here, right? Because if we return to the Weberian definition, which I've brought up, of a state as a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence, that I think applies kind of internally within the state. That is to say, the state can use violence coercively to protect to manage relations among its citizens. But it also seems to apply to like maintaining armies for protection of the state from other states at a higher level of abstraction. So this, if you accept accept this definition, what it requires is that you train specialists in violence, police forces and military forces. And, you know, and it's probably a good idea that those two functions are separate.
Right.
And, you know, we have the Posse Comitatus Act and whatnot. You know, for which I refer everyone to the West Wing. But the, you know, that great civics lesson of primetime television. But the interesting dodge here is that our specialists in violence for protection, you know, military force, need to be children because they are mentally flexible in a way that. Adults aren't, or at least they need to be, their training needs to start as children because it, you know, you gather from the book that there's years of battle school. And then as a teacher, you go to as a teenager, you go to pre-command school and then you go to command school. Right.
Right. I think that's the theory of battle school is that normally it's just the beginning of a long pipeline to rise to command.
Sure. And it's like you're coming out, what, in your early 20s as a low ranking member of the officer corps. And it's kind of like you just happen to have gone to not just to one of the service academies, but to like a K-12 service academy,
you know?
But we get the sense that something is different with Ender. And so like, not only does he need to be trained and the need for him to be trained is imminent. And there's been some talk about why that is, or some rumblings of how urgent the situation is. But he also needs to be trained without knowledge, because you know he can't actually be a specialist in violence, though he would be a great specialist in violence because of the old problem. And it's, you kind of see it in the Locke and Demosthenes chapter of, you know, no one capable of getting themselves elected really should be allowed to rule. And, you know, sort of no one suited to the role of the use of violence ought to, I think, direct the use of violence. And I guess that's the idea anyway behind civilian control of the U.S. military anyway. But there's a whole bunch of tensions that this gets at. But before we get too deep into that, we've gone this far without even our plot summary. So will you tell us from the perspective of your great expertise in Ender's Game, what happens in chapters 11 and 12?
Sure. And I do want to get back to the monopoly on the use of violence because I think it plays out in this chapter in an interesting way. But this is chapter 11 and 12. Chapter 11 is Veni, Vidi, Vici. And this is, to me, these two chapters are kind of the heart of the book, particularly Veni, Vidi, Vici, because this is all of the battles in the battle room. This opens with Ender getting his first battle as a commander of Dragon Army. And then it takes us through kind of the first week or two of his command of Dragon Army and all the ways his strategy and training play out in real life. So we get his first battle where his, you know, new tactics, he can completely cut up Rabbit Army in the formation. We get then his first experience in the commander's mess and how all the commanders are kind of pissed off at him because he did so well. And then he just, it kind of elides over the details, but we learn that he's fought battle after battle and he's doing better than anybody's ever done. And then it ends, the chapter pretty much ends with him defeating Salamander Army, where Salamander Army found out about the battle 10 minutes before he did. And so they're waiting outside the door. And so Ender has to use this creative formation in order to beat Salamander. And this kind of plants the seeds of hatred, or at least maybe grows the seeds. The seeds probably started back when Ender was in his army, but it fertilizes the garden of Bonzo's hatred against Ender. And so the next chapter is appropriately Bonzo. And so this is the chapter where It starts off with the battle with Badger Army, where the other side unfreezes after like a few minutes, but Ender's Army doesn't. Then immediately after that, and I find that interesting. I want to hit that battle later. But immediately after that battle, Ender goes to the showers and is attacked by Bonzo, and that's where they have their fight. And then immediately after that battle, kind of without letting up, the teachers send him into the battle against two armies. And this is where we get the enemy's gate is down, and they kind of hack the rules a little bit by going straight for the gate instead of trying to defeat the armies.
Right.
And then the chapter ends.
Huh.
So that's where we're at.
So that is an interesting thing, isn't it? That is to say, there is a he wins by technical knockout, right?
Right.
And that's I don't know. That's it's foreshadowing something that's going to happen later. But the idea that the idea that he will, pursue a strategy ulterior to the strategy that he purports to be pursuing, in service of, he's really, God, I'm stammering all this out, but what he's really playing the teachers at this point. He's not playing the other army, you know?
Right.
Right, that is to say, he's suffering huge losses, and you know, no one's in Frozen, but he does the thing that ends the game, right? He he Kobayashi Maru's it a little bit.
I like the bit where he's thinking to himself, this is kind of halfway through this battle, he's thinking to himself, like, what happens if this doesn't work? If, like, they touch the gates and nothing happens, is he just going to yell, I win? Like, which kind of, I don't know, brings back, you know, memories of, like, kids' games where you're, like, you disagree on the rules and somebody's just screaming, I win!
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I've honestly found in professional life especially, like, a lot can be accomplished by declaring victory.
Right, you move the goalposts to where you are and declare victory.
Exactly, like congratulations, team. We've deployed such. Anyway, the idea of these battles is there are a number of directions that we can go. One is that the idea of these battles is that they're not fair, and Anderson has been. Anderson has been planning these kind of stacked deck battles, and there's a progression to them. They get harder and harder. The terrain, or rather the organization of stars in the battle room, the circumstances get harder and harder. And really, it's just the weakness of the other. It's the weakness of the other teams, right? That I don't know. That Ender wins kind of by playing his opponent without even under the conditions of having the deck stacked against him.
Right, and it's interesting. The reason I brought up the Badger Army, I think it's interesting the different methods employed to stack the deck. Because kind of at the beginning, and with the meta conditions of the game, without actually playing with the conditions of the game, by like putting Ender's Army in a battle weeks before they expected it, giving him late notice of the battle so that only a few minutes notice so they don't have time to shower. So they're kind of harder, and then gradually they get to the just have to start outright changing the rules of the game to make it unfair against Ender. Like at the beginning of the game, it's like if you make people play football with only a couple hours sleep. Later on, it's like, well, the other team gets five downs and you only get four. And then, of course, at the end, it's the most difficult, where it's two armies. It's just like you get 11 players and they get 22.
And they have assault rifles.
Right, like a Last Boy Scout. Another great example of use of a metagame in order to influence the outcome of a game.
But there are two. So, I mean, there are a number of games. going on at the same time. And it's, I'm not sure game is the right metaphor, but there are a number of
maybe contests.
Yeah, contests, or also there's a number of discrete objectives at different levels of abstraction that Ender's working within, and it's, and he's successful at some and a failure at others. And I think it's interesting to like analyze the shower fight with Bonzo as a failure of playing a diplomatic game, right, among your peers in school, you know. So there's, right, and it's a question of when you my physics teacher in high school used to love saying it's a question of when you open your eyes. Right, like if you open your eyes after you throw the ball's moving through the air, but there's no force acting on, you know, like, well, gravity, I guess, but you know what I mean,
right?
And it also kind of depends. He was fond of saying it depends how big you draw your circle, right? Like, yes, all the parts of the car are pushing against each other, but if you draw your circle around the car, you know, the car's just a block of wood, and you can do your Newtonian stuff on the car as a whole. So like if you draw the circle around the battle room, that's one thing. But if you draw the circle around the battle school with dormitories and lunchrooms and game rooms and classrooms and social interactions, I mean, even if Ender is kind of alienated from a lot of those social interactions, there still is a sense that beyond the scope of the battle itself, there is a protocol for dealing with one another. And, you know, he draws up his army in ranks and then, you know, accepts the dignified surrender of the other commander. And then, you know, like there's a process, a kind of a face-saving process, which is a ritual to manage. I mean, games, in a sense, are rituals to manage aggression. And, you know, talking about football, like Friday Night Lights is actually a very good TV show that's a lab for this kind of thing. And we've talked about it on the TFT podcast a little bit. But there are rituals also around games for managing aggression, right? Like, and you know, I don't know if you know your coach as a, you know, young boy playing sports forced you, as mine did, to like, you know, line up and shake the other team's hand and you say good game, and then, you know, you do a little cheer for the other team, and then you go eat your orange slices.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's pretty universal, at least at the young level. Yeah, because it's a way of, you know, hopefully harshing over the feelings of the, you know, whatever the. Keeping the game in the game, I guess, is the goal of those rituals.
Right. And so that, so that the game functions effectively as a container for, container for sublimating aggression, or for, you know, sublimating certain other kinds of social forces that can come out in more destructive ways. And he doesn't do this with Bonzo, and in fact, like, sort of humiliates him by having Bean insult his tactics, right? Like,
right. I'll take issue with you somewhat that I don't think the problem is that Ender is drawing his circle too small. I think it's that he's drawing it too big, because to Ender, the circle includes the buggers and it includes the teachers. And so to Ender, the important contest that's going on is Ender's relationship with the teachers and how that affects the war with the buggers. There's a line where he's talking to Bean. And he tries to elicit from Bean that what's important is the buggers, and he says, like, it's really important that you understand that. And so Ender doesn't really think about what he's doing to Bonzo, because he's thinking about the broader game with the teachers.
Sure. It also seems like he's sort of compromised in terms of his, like, you know, his mental state at that,
right.
You know what I mean? At that moment. So then another kind of game, or another kind of set of goals that's discrete and at a lower level of abstraction, is the command of his army. And we talked a little bit about this, but we get one really great little detail about Ender as a commander here, as a leader, which is so interesting. at the near the beginning of Veni, Vidi, Vici, he says, the narrator says, the soldiers knew by now that... Oh, now I've lost my place. That Ender could be brutal in the way he talked to groups, but when he worked with an individual, he was always patient, explaining as often as necessary, making suggestions quietly, listening to questions and problems and explanations. But he never laughed when they tried to banter with him, and they soon stopped trying. He was commander every moment they were together. He never had to remind them of it. He simply was. You know, and this is very good. This is very, very good... sort of leadership or supervision, right? If you've ever had a teacher or a professor or a TA or a camp counselor or a, I don't know, priest or a, what, you know, whatever authority figure who wants to pretend they're like, want they're pals with you instead of having the role that they actually have. And, you know, I'm all for everybody being informal because I think that, you know, we're all too uptight all the damn time, But like, if there's someone who really wants to sort of refuse to acknowledge different roles, it can be really destructive to the cohesion of a group. And so this sort of sense that he is just there, you know, is a really effective way. And then the idea of talking to groups versus talking to individuals, I think, as I read this, and tell me what you think, but this has to do with different levels of accountability, you know, like as a person, you're sort of competing against yourself as an individual, and your job is to try your best and to improve and to, you know, to really do that. And a whole lot of harshness is not necessarily productive in that scenario. But as a team, you're playing the enemy, and there's a very, you know, there are stakes, and there's a very clear delineation of winners and losers. And as a team, the level of accountability is different. It is much higher, I think, than the level of accountability of any one individual within a team. I don't know. I could poke holes in that also. That's a straw man, but I'll leave it to you to do that.
I think that's right on, because I think what Ender's doing there is if you tell a group of people, we are not doing X, we are not accomplishing our goals, hopefully that's encouraging people to start working together to find solutions, to help each other out. You know, if one guy is having trouble, then the guy who's good at that particular skill is going to pull him aside and try to help him out, because we're all not good enough. So we all need to get across the line. But as you said, in the individual context, that doesn't do a lot of good. You know, if you just yell at somebody that they're not a very good shot, it's not going to make them a better shot. And I think Ender does recognize that it's possible to go up and down in the way you deal with people without necessarily sacrificing your role as a commander. I was listening to your guys' TFT podcast this morning, and you were talking about kind of the inability for certain sentences to ever be true. I don't know if that's exactly how you phrased it, but like, if you say, "I'm not stupid," it kind of proves itself. In the same way that if you say, "I am in command," or "I am in control," it undermines your position, because if you're really in command or if you're really in control, you don't need to say it because everybody knows it.
Right.
And Ender kind of intuitively understands that he just has to be the commander, and then he never actually has to remind anybody that he's the commander. Whereas Bonzo had to do this all the time. But Bonzo was constantly telling people that he was in authority, he was in control, and as a result, he lost control of his army more so than Ender does.
Yeah, it's really, it's really interesting that the skill that Ender has for leadership. I mean, even more, almost even more than for strategy. You know,
right. There's one little detail that I caught that I really liked that. Is kind of Ender's psychological management of his army. And I don't mean this by like psychological tricks, but like there's a lot of focus in these chapters on kind of mundane details like food, you know, when he's going to allow them to have breakfast, when he's going to allow them to have a shower, when right before the first battle, he has them lie down on their mats for a couple minutes, just kind of to get their heads right. And I think this is a really interesting detail that Ender understands that his army are human and that they have these human needs that need to be serviced. We talked about it a little bit last week, and a little, I think it got touched on a little bit in the forums, where we're talking about how Ender's strategy of telling people that the enemy's gate is down is a recognition of the fact that you can't just tell people there is no down, because people just can't handle that. And I think this is a similar thing, where Ender is leading people and not automatons. He's not trying to lead robots or abstractions. So by doing this, he gets their loyalty, because they recognize that he understands their needs.
Right, and there's a real practical intelligence as opposed to a kind of moral absolutism, right? Like, for Bonzo, you get the sense that it's command, or sort of being a commander, an army commander, is sort of a moral absolute, and kind of goes to, like, I don't know, his value as a person. You know what I mean? For Ender, there are goals, and then there are practical ways of accomplishing those goals. You know, like, just as it would be no good to kind of run your army ragged physically before a battle, right? It's no good to have them be distracted or scared or, I don't know, psychologically compromised, such that they can't perform optimally. And the book, I mean, I don't know, for the 80s, the book is sort of progressive in the way that it looks at that. It looks at that aspect of high stress, stuff like war fighting. And there's going to be an instance of this later on in the, book that we'll talk about next week. That's going to be sort of interesting.
Right.
So that was my sort of read, like, that there are levels of abstraction and sort of levels of game, or sort of levels of objective, and, like, you know, within the army, between the armies, between the students, and then the larger one between between Ender and the teachers, or really Graf, who is his sort of rabbi, right? Who is kind of the one who's preparing him, who's sort of doing these things to prepare him. And, like, the teachers are the real enemy, and it's going to become important, the idea that, like, the relationship between teacher and enemy. At the risk of dating this, well, I'll try to leave out specifics, but at the risk of dating this podcast, I recently, in my other career as a professional theater actor, just opened a play that we've been rehearsing for several months, I wish, weeks, and we'll be playing. The whole process is several months, rehearsal and performance. We didn't know, and we sort of talked a little bit about the audience being the teacher, not the enemy so much, though they sometimes feel
the audience,
like,
is the enemy.
Sometimes feels like that, though, on a Sunday matinee when they're unwrapping their hard candies. I mean, for goodness sakes, people. But we didn't know. It's a comedy. It's a slapstick. There's a lot of physical comedy and a lot of mugging and a lot of pratfalls and stuff like that. We didn't know where the laughs were. And if you don't know where the laughs are in a comedy, you don't know the play that you're doing. And so the idea that the audience is the teacher, because they're going to tell you what's funny, and they're going to tell you what's good. And conversely, they're going to tell you what's bad, because they won't laugh, and they'll stop and it'll go. And it is dispiriting in the extreme to be, paid to entertain people and to have them sit there and not laugh. So the idea that the enemy, the adversary, or your opposite number is the teacher, right? Is the one who's really gonna evaluate your work and let you know how you did, if you're attentive to those signals, is something that's going to become important next week. But it's also, it's also already in play here with, Graf being a teacher and also being an enemy.
Right. And what, this is a slightly different direction, but while we're on the topic of graph, this is just something I got to get off my chest here, because it's a topic that came up a little bit in the chapters from a couple weeks ago, but I wanted to wait because there's a couple just choice lines in here. So I'm going to reach back to chapter 8, and there's a great line from Graph where he says, "This is something to be decided by people who know what they're doing, not these frightened politicians who got their office because they happen to be politically potent in the country they come from." And then jumping ahead to this week for chapter 12, where he's justifying not protecting Ender. And he says, "Damn Dap and damn you too. I know what I'm doing better than anyone else." And this is kind of like Graf in a nutshell, that he is like, he's almost religious in his fervor for his plan to save the Earth. And he is absolutely convinced that this is the way to go. And he's willing to do pretty much anything in service of this plan. And it's a very technocratic mindset, where to graph the procedure by which we protect the Earth is not particularly important. But his plan is the best plan, and this is the only plan that we're going to pursue.
Right, and the idea, you see, you sort of earn the right to make statements like this, right? Like you earn right. the right to say, "Because I said so." I mean, unless you're a parent, in which case I suppose it's your absolute right to say that to children. But you know, try doing it. They'll, you know, round 12, 13, they'll stop listening to that one, unless you have something to back it up with, right? Like, and the right to say "I said so" in a democracy anyway is tied to the political process, right? Like we get to choose who has the right to say "Because I said so." And I mean, it's interesting to think about, Graf, you know, as a non-elected, leader, right? As a kind of warlord. And you get the sense that, politically on Earth, people talk about the international fleet, yeah, as being potentially a political faction, a power base in itself, that is non-democratic, but that is sort of mostly responsive to American interests. But that it's a concern on Earth that after, you know, the third invasion, whenever it comes from those pesky buggers, there is this kind of anxiety about the military as a kind of rival for actual political power without recourse to, you know, electoral politics.
Right. I think this is kind of that the IF was built by people like Graf, who see this mission as being above politics, that because the survival of the species is that it justifies just about anything in service of this mission.
Sure. I mean that, and I think that's probably okay. You probably can still do that in a constitutional democracy, right? But you have to get that ratified by the people first, right?
Right. Like, right. Know. Whereas Graf kind of wants to skip that step.
Yeah. Well, time is short, right?
This right. Is the, but you know. And I can't comment on that too much without getting into. Specifics of that.
No, but there, I mean, there's been some no, sense but, without right. getting into some yeah, yeah, specifics that. of the actual climax of the book. We've had some sense that, like, oh, I hope it's ready in time. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's a sense of kind of some kind of ticking clock, though exactly how long we're not yet sure.
Absolutely. And so that presumably that might be, you know, a kind of exigent circumstance that we're willing to forgive.
Yeah. Okay, so then we probably should move on a little bit to talking about the shower fight.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, which is, you know, you called in the forum sort of the emotional heart of the book. I mean, taken together with the previous chapter, emotional and otherwise, you know, thematic, intellectual, you know, plot-wise heart of the book. And it also, I mean, if this were a three-act structure, this is sort of the end of Act Two, and then we're going to enter an interlude and go into the final act. You know, so this is the sort of Act Two climax. Well, I don't know. I don't have a more specific question to ask rather than what do you have to say about the shower fight?
Well, before we get into the fight itself, I want to touch back on what we were talking about with the monopoly on the use of violence and how that concept plays out in an interesting way in this scene, because we know that, you know, Graf has a monopoly on the use of legitimate violence in the battle school. He controls the soldiers that control the students. He could stop the chooses to let Bonzo attack Ender, and that he's not going to do anything about it. And that kind of highlights an interesting feature of the monopoly on the use of violence, which is that both you can both stop people from doing violence and you can allow people to do violence. And both is something the state may or may not be prepared to do.
Calling Graf a state, it's interesting because, like, just our last little conversation sort of calls into question the source from which his legitimacy derives, but it's true that he is the authority on, you know, at the battle school, right?
Right. He's the representative that controls the monopoly on the use of violence in the battle school.
Yeah, yeah. And however he got there, it's true that from the point of view of a student, he's the arbiter of those kinds of things.
Right. And I guess the little vignette at the beginning where he's arguing with what I think we're meant to assume is the general in charge of him. So it's clear that he's not making these decisions 100% unilaterally. Like, there are people with the authority to countermand his orders. He's not Kim Jong-il. Like, he does have limits. But since no one's exercising them, he's effectively in charge.
Yeah.
But so I guess we should get into the Bonzo fight.
And that, so what you're bringing up is sort of like, does it sort of legitimize, does it legitimize what happens somehow? I mean, like, I don't know. Maybe it's a rat hole to get into a discussion of legitimacy and you know, the sources of legitimacy for the use of force. But the idea that, like, you know, Ender didn't look for this. Ender didn't look for this fight. He didn't. You know, he didn't want this fight. But everyone knew it was coming, including the authorities, and no one did anything to prevent it because he has to. He sort of has to be in. He has to be in this fight, and he has to believe. He has to believe that he's on his own, that he's entirely thrown back on his own resources, and that there's no cavalry coming. I mean, I don't know. What do you think? What do you think of this? Is this a feature of a good commander, or that there is no cavalry, there is no air support, there is no help on the other end of the phone?
I mean, it's interesting. I guess it's only a feature if you're assuming that Ender is going to be the number one person in the military. Like, for anyone else in the military, there is cavalry. Like, if you're even a ship captain, there's other ships that you can call. You know, or if you're a fleet captain, there are other fleets that you can call. But only if you're the number one guy, the man in charge, who already has all of the resources. Does it matter that, okay, you better make it space warfare sort of makes sense, because when you're fighting in space, presumably the cavalry is light years away, and so it's not going to come in time to make any difference. So I guess it does make sense to instill that in Ender, who they are planning to make the number one, who they are planning to put all their hopes on.
Yeah.
So it's not a general leadership strategy, but I think it might make sense in the limited context of Ender.
Sure. And is this, I mean, you know, and I don't know, is this sort of necessary, right? Like, it's the thing that Graf is doing here is kind of cutting across all the levels of abstraction, right? All the levels of all the levels of games, right? Like, because no one's coming for him in the battle room, no one's coming for him in the shower, you know, no one's coming in the cold, dark vacuum of space,
right? And
Graf
kind of assumes that genius that Ender is, he's incapable of moving between these levels of abstractions. That Ender won't be able to internalize, I guess, because clearly he'd be able to understand it. But Graf is worried that Ender won't be able to internalize the difference between a battle in the shower and a battle in space, which I don't 100% buy.
Yeah, no, but it does make for compelling drama, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
And so one thing that I think we can move to the kind of the specifics of the battle that I think is really fascinating here is the concept of kind of honor and the rules and how those play out. Because obviously that's what Ender uses to his advantage, is he uses this Bonzo's concept of honor. There's an interesting line just before the battle in the shower from the commander of Badger Army, who was the he was the beneficiary of the change in the rules that meant that his soldiers would unfreeze and Ender's soldiers wouldn't. And they're kind of joking back and forth where he's saying, like, oh, I wish if I want to beat you, I want to do it fair. And Ender says, look, if you have an advantage, you use it. And Slattery's like, oh, yeah, I use the advantage. It's just I'm fair-minded before and after battles. And there's this interesting idea that to pull Slattery, at least, like, fairness has its place. You know, in the game, because everybody agrees to play the game, it's okay to be kind of unfair. But then for that kind of gets turned on its head when we're dealing with Bonzo, for whom honor is everything. And so fairness exists as a concept regardless of the context.
Yeah, that is to say there's kind of an internal game that he's always playing that no one has consented to play with him.
Right.
But that is super important to him, and he's constantly monitoring his standings in this sort of internal game that has to do with honor and also with sort of dominance, right? Because honor, you know, I don't know. I think that you can be an honorable subordinate or an honorable servant, right? But that's not what Bonzo is about. He's about, you know, being honorable and being sort of unquestioningly in charge or unquestioned in his, you know, dominance over everybody. So, I mean, there are a bunch of examples of Ender playing his opponent, right? Like, admitting defeat before Bonzo attacks him, or sort of, you know, giving a sort of sign of submission. But then also, you know, I don't know, using terrain to his advantage, like turning on the hot water. Mm-hmm. There is up to the point where Dink points out how important Ender is to the war. Like, because Dink is another one who understands the real game, right? Who understands the sort of interstellar level of the game. Up until that point, there is maybe some hope that he can talk his way out of it, but when Dink comes in and points out how important Ender will be for the war, you know, Ender reflects himself, well, that did it. Now there's no getting out of this without a fight, because Dink doesn't realize, as Ender does, what Bonzo's sort of private game is in this situation.
Right, and of course, Dink's argument is a good one. Like,
oh no, Dink's right,
and that's just what's interesting. As you say, it's Ender understands that Bonzo's playing by different rules, and so this good argument that makes perfect sense isn't going to work with Bonzo. It might work with the other boys, but it's not going to work with Bonzo, who's playing by his own rules. So I think that's well put.
Yeah, and again, Ender is practical, right? The fact that Dink is right kind of doesn't obtain, and it's really the problem is the fact that Dink is not useful, right? Not helpful at this moment,
right.
You know. I mean, have you ever had in like in a work situation been and this is worse with people who like send their phone numbers and email, and then you ask their phone number and it's like, did you see the email? And I just want to scream at people like that. Like, do you want to solve this problem or do you want to be right?
Right. You
know? Like, and there are points at which the truth is in fact not a useful component of getting things done. And this is one of them.
That's a good observation.
Yeah.
And so the forums, and we should probably talk about it briefly, is like Ender's choice here to fight and Ender's choice to do some serious damage to Bones, ultimately to kill Bones. So we don't think that's really his intent to do, but to use potentially lethal force against Bonzo, because we're back to the same argument or same, I guess, internal motivation that Ender used when he was fighting Stilson, which is that he needs to win the battle now decisively to avoid future battles. Because once again, he's faced with a situation where he knows that he could walk away right then because he's beaten Bonzo badly enough that Bonzo's not getting up, at least in the next minute. But he hits him again because he wants to make sure that Bonzo doesn't come back.
Yeah, it's the Powell doctrine, right? You know,
like, can you expand on that? I think I know what you're talking about, but go ahead.
The Colin Powell doctrine,
right,
of, you know, we'll only commit the American military to situations where a number of factors are true. One is our vital interests are at stake. Two is we can use overwhelming force. And three, we have a clear exit strategy. I'll make sure there's not more. Not more than that, but like it's like winning and then having to fight the same battle again, it's not interesting to Ender. He sees the problem of that.
Right. Well, it's just kind of the idea that if something is worth fighting for, it is worth a complete fight with no holds barred. That there's no purpose to restrained violence, because if you have rules in the first place, then you can probably avoid the violent situation. So you should only be using violence when absolutely necessary. And in that case, let loose, do everything you can.
Right. Yeah. I mean, go big or go home. I guess so. Okay, so there are a number of aspects to the Powell Doctrine that I didn't name, but those are a lot of them are political in nature. Those are the ones we have to be threatened in some sort of vital security interest. Non-violent means have to be exhausted. We have to be able to have a really attainable objective and be able to get out. And I guess Ender doesn't want to be entangled in a long cold war with Bonzo in battle school.
Right. Well, and it's worth mentioning here that, and this is interesting, the Powell Doctrine, you know, Colin Powell came up in the Vietnam era, and then in particular in the post-Vietnam era of U.S. military thought, where that was very fresh in our minds, this idea of the sense among most U.S. military thinkers post-Vietnam was that we tied our own hands. We put these kind of restrictions because we weren't willing to go all the way towards winning the war, and that's why we lost. And, of course, Ender's Game was written in the 80s, when post-Cold War military thought was still, you know, the dominant way of looking at the world. That was the thing that was still on everybody's mind was Vietnam. And so I think that's reflected here in this philosophy.
Sure. And in the idea that, you know, after the bugger threat is eliminated, right, the pull march or the, I don't know, what is the Russian leader called?
I think it's the pole march is the Russian representative of the IF high command, I think.
Oh, I see. Right. But, well, whoever, like, within the Warsaw Pact, there's going to be problems, right? Like, the world can't exist in this state of kind of balanced balanced tensions, you know,
right.
of sort of productively counterbalanced tensions. It's sort of all or nothing.
Right. That Russia realizes that they need to go all out. They need to win the war.
Yeah.
Right in the first day of the war.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we should probably leave it there. This has been one heck of a great discussion, as it usually is. Thank you very much, Ben.
Yeah, it's been great. We came, we saw, we podcasted.
We podcasted. And this podcast was not a game. What do you think this is? Some kind of podcast? This is just a Skype discussion that we're having man on man with no one listening to it. So I'm not afraid of a little hot water.
With the fate of the world on the line.
You can join the discussion in the forums. There is an Ender's Game book club forum, and just remember to post in the appropriate section, or if you want to do all spoilers for all books, post in the full book forum. Also, in one of the forum topics, we've actually asked for feedback on how you've liked the book club so far. We'd love to hear that, because we'd like to continue doing these. This one has been fun, so we'll plan the next one, whether it's pegged to a major movie release or not. We can always learn and always improve, because we are good commanders, like Ender is. And you can always find this and more on the web at overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.